Happy Friday. Good Friday for a lot of you. Hope you have a big weekend ahead because I got a big night for you. Do you know the story, if you watch the show, I think you do, of the man who set fire to his own home to be rescued? Because he says he was trapped in the attic for 21 years by a stepmother who lived downstairs and a father who died last year, but then the abuse got worse, he says. When they found him, firefighters said he was 68 pounds, filthy dirty, emaciated, hair matted, and speaking very freely about having been a prisoner for 2 decades. He's now speaking out. I am going to tell you everything that he has said about what his past has been, tell you about something very special that's just happened to him, and also I have the stepmother's attorney on the show tonight. I cannot wait to speak with this man because publicly he has said 68 pounds, could be all sorts of reasons for that. And if he was trapped up there for 21 years, where are the handcuffs and the restraints? I've got lots of questions. He's going to join me live in just a moment. Do not go anywhere. Then also, a bombshell in Brian Koberger's case. Every so often, I'm working away diligently on the show, and I think I've got the whole thing planned. And then, boom, something drops in Idaho. And today, that happened. Early this evening, we got more documents. And I love that. Hate it. For planning purposes, but love it because we've been under a gag order for 2.5 years. So every morsel of information that I get in that case, you get it right away. And tonight does not disappoint. Turns out there is more to that whole buying of the K-bar knife and knife sheath, a lot more to it. And maybe the thing that happened after the purchase might be more telling than the actual purchase itself, if you believe the prosecutors. Okay, I will tell you what that is, but you have to hear it. It is a big, big shoe to drop in that case, not one that's good for Koberger. And then you know how this goes. Bodies are found. They start turning up. People start saying, I think this looks like the work of a serial killer. Police say, no, that's not the case here. That's not what's happening here. Please, people, it's never a serial killer until it's a serial killer. That's the way it works. Every one of our big serial killer stories started out as it's not a serial killer. And then all of a sudden, things started to fit into place. We may have one of those again tonight, actually taking shape in New England because bodies are turning up and the stories are strange. They're also keeping things quiet. But we've got someone to talk about this tonight who in Connecticut was stabbed 27 times and survived. Maybe the only survivor of that serial killer. And she is going to tell us why we need to take heed about what is happening in New England. I'll lay it all out for you in just a moment. Let me start here, though. Hard to imagine how you would rebuild your life if the building blocks of your life were only just a couple of years. But that is what a Connecticut man is facing after being freed from captivity since the age of 11. 21 years of being locked in the attic and fed so little he weighed just 68 pounds. That man is now 32 years old and he goes by the name of S. He chose that name himself. He says he's changed his name and he's starting a new life after just weeks ago setting that attic fire that was his ticket to freedom. You've probably heard the details of what happened, but now S is talking himself, making his first public statements since he was rescued by the first responders. His stepmother was in that fire too, and she also made it out alive. But ironically, she may end up locked away for many years herself after being charged with holding S in captivity behind locked doors since he was in fourth grade. Kimberly Sullivan has tonight pleaded not guilty. She is out on $300,000 bond, and her lawyer is going to be with me in just a hot minute with her side of the story. But the details that S himself has provided are nothing short of harrowing. He says he was kept on the verge of starvation, even drinking water from a toilet when the water was scarce. And speaking of the toilet, he says he was forced to urinate out of a tube that went through the third story window and was reduced to defecating in newspapers. I mentioned that S is finally speaking out. And that's because he's released a lengthy statement that I would like to read for you in its entirety tonight. So get comfy. Please call me S. This is not the name given to me by my parents when I was born. I am choosing a new name for myself, and I will use that name as I reclaim control over my life and my future. My name is my choice, and it is the first of many choices I will make for myself now that I am free. I am a survivor of more than 20 years of captivity and domestic abuse. I was held prisoner in my home from the time I was taken out of the fourth grade at age 11 until 2 months ago at age 31, when I purposely set that fire that helped set me free. I am speaking out today to begin the process of reclaiming my life and to have my say in how my story is told. I am much better and stronger than I was the day the first responders carried me out of my home. I am beyond grateful for the care that I have received since then. To all the healthcare professionals who have helped me and nurtured me, thank you. In addition to all of your care, I appreciated the chance to have my first ever birthday party to celebrate turning 32. I also want to thank the first responders, the law enforcement investigators, and everyone who is working to hold those responsible for my abuse accountable. Thank you to everyone at Safe Haven Waterbury and everyone who has given to the GoFundMe page that will help cover some of the overwhelming expenses I will face in the weeks and months and years to come. I am grateful to the conservator and my attorney who will help guide me through the legal process ahead. They have been invaluable to me, and I am grateful for their tireless support. Much has already been said that tells part of the story of the abuse I endured. Someday, perhaps, my whole story will be told. I ask everyone involved in my story to fully cooperate with the authorities who are helping me seek justice for these crimes. I also ask the public and the media to respect those investigations and my privacy as this process plays out. This isn't just a story, it's my life. Thank you all for your thoughts and messages, your support, and your continued prayers as I recover. Please forward any inquiries about my recovery, requests for information or interviews for the process ahead to David Guarino at Survivors Say, who has volunteered to serve as my spokesman. Thank you. That presents a very steep hill for Kimberly Sullivan, his stepmother, to climb, explaining the matted and filthy condition that first responders said they found him in, explaining the locks discovered by police on the outside of the attic door. Here are a few answers that Kimberly Sullivan's lawyer has provided so far.
Where are the handcuffs? Where are the chains? Where are the signs of restraint? Those pictures raise a lot of questions if you look at them objectively. And as far as his weight, I haven't seen any medical records yet, and there may be other explanations for his weight. Ask a doctor. That's not for me to explain. There could be a lot of reasons, and we may raise some more of those questions, but now's not the time for me to guess as to why he was 68 pounds.
Joining me now is the man that you just heard, Kimberly Sullivan's lawyer, Ioannis Kaloudis. Thank you so much for being on the program. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me, Ashley. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I do appreciate, this is going to be a tough interview. This is a very painful subject, as you can imagine, and the public is outraged at the things that they've heard. Can I start with this, Ioannis? Has Kimberly Sullivan downloaded you on her entire side of the story?
It's happening, but it's happening over time. We've met numerous times. We've gone over the allegations numerous times. We're reviewing all the discovery as we get it. So it is a work in progress, but I've had extensive conversations with her regarding these allegations.
So first and foremost, what is her response to the statement that has come from her stepson?
She is shocked that this continues to grow in magnitude. She is shocked that everyone has condemned her and automatically believed everything that has come out by the state and the allegations made by the police and by the accuser in this case. She's blown away.
Well, that's brief. And the statement was long and very, very detailed. And the things that her stepson has said to first responders were very detailed as well. Why would her stepson say these things about her?
Well, so great question. And that's something he's going to have to answer. And that's something he's going to have to answer for under cross-examination at trial. We have a number of theories as to why he may be saying the things he's saying. And none of them because
what
they're true.
They?
Well, I mean, that's what he's going to be cross-examined on. I mean, right now, no one's asking him the tough questions. And yeah, it was detailed. I respectfully disagree. What we don't have is any information as to how he was restrained in any way. All we're told is that
there are locks on the outside door. There's locks on the outside of the door up in the attic. That's restraint.
No, it's not. That is a lock on the outside of a door. Restraint is actually using physical force to restrain someone. From what I understand, he literally just walked into this room and she locked the door behind him, and that's what kept him captive for 20 years.
Well, he's 68 pounds, and since 11th grade, if you follow his story, he was 11 years old when he ended up in captivity, and the pressure, fear, and stress kept him in abeyance of their threats. This is what he has said, that he was locked behind those doors, the locks are visible, and that he was barely fed, which is why he's 68 pounds. Why is that hard to believe?
Why is it hard? Let's look at this objectively. Any parent who has ever raised a child and has told their child, go to your room, what child is going to stay in that room and not put up a fight ever? 21 years, no physical force, no physical restraint, nothing other than being told, get in your room, and then literally one of those chain locks, a $5 lock, is what kept them in captivity for 20 years.
Let's talk.
The story doesn't make sense.
Mr. Cloyes, I'm not a lawyer, but I am a parent, and I had two rambunctious boys. And I can tell you one thing, it is against the law to lock them inside of a room. It is against the law to have a lock on the outside of the room with your child on the inside of the room. That is just a fact. How do you explain these locks on the outside of the room where he says he was held for so many years?
There were exterior locks on almost every door inside that house, and those locks predated my client ever moving in the house. The existence of the lock, the presence of the lock, doesn't prove anything, is not illegal. They are going to need to convince a jury that those locks were actually used to restrain him in that room.
Understand that. How about the part where S says he overheard his stepmother telling two friends who were brought over before the fire responders arrived to, number one, clean up your face, wash the dirt off your face, and to the friends, help me get the locks off these doors?
Great. I mean, it's great that he's saying that, because the evidence I've seen does not support that. The body camera footage does not support that. The person he claims was there to remove the locks was not even present when the first responder showed up. Couldn't even get to the house. Never actually made it to the
house. How do you explain the conditions that we see? And granted, there was a fire, but I've also seen fire damage, and I can tell the difference between fire damage and severe neglect. How do you explain the conditions that he was living in up in that attic, especially the toileting facilities? I mean, there's going to be plenty of evidence, if it exists, there'll be plenty of evidence that urine had to go out a window, as did feces.
So, respectfully, it was not actually an attic. It was on the second floor, and it was a room that...
He said third.
When you walk in the house, if you go straight up the stairs and to the left is where the room was. It was on the second floor. It was next to a bathroom and next to two other rooms. The condition of the room...
He said it was the third floor. He said it was the third floor. He was quite clear about that to the first responders.
He's wrong about that, as he's wrong about plenty of things. And all that will come out at trial. I've been inside the home. I've walked up one flight of stairs. I've inspected the room myself. There's a lot of problems with his story. And part of the problem is that everyone has accepted everything he has said as the truth, as the Bible. And it is not the truth. And we will push back on that.
So can I ask you this? Does Kimberly Sullivan, your client, have evidence to refute the things he said? And I'll list a few things off. He says he's never had a birthday party. I have so many photos of my children's birthday parties, I can't even find all of them. But I've got plenty of evidence to refute that if someone said it about me. Has she got photos of birthday parties for this child?
So respectfully, I think one of the problems we're having is everyone expects Kimberly Sullivan to prove her innocence. And the great thing about America is we don't have to do that. The state has to prove their case. They have a heavy burden here.
You want to prove it to a jury, though, Mr. Kaloidis? You know you're going to have to prove something to a jury. And if he says something you say is a lie, can't you show the evidence to show here are the birthday parties? Does she have pictures of birthday parties for this boy?
We're not putting forward any pictures now. We have a number of pictures of this child throughout the years, and those will come out at the appropriate time. What I can tell you is his birthday was celebrated every year. There was cake.
With a photo?
There was presents. We don't need photos.
With a photo?
You don't have to take photos.
Well, if I were a juror, I'd say, show me the money. You know, jurors want to see evidence of these things.
And that's, respectfully, that's the problem. Everyone wants to shift the burden onto the defense, and we're not going to let that happen. The burden rests on the state.
Well, Mr. Kaloidis, you know how this works. I said it's a tough hill to climb. I mean it. It is I have been to this rodeo before. And you do have to present some kind of a case if they've got a strong case against you, which is why I asked you if you have the photos. How about a doctor's record or dentist record? Do you have doctors and dentist records for his entire growing up?
We have 200 pages of DCF records that we just got this week, which show unsubstantiated. There was concerns about
I'm sorry, that wasn't my question. I understand the DCFS. I was actually getting to that. That's question number 14.
There's medical records in there. That's why.
Doctors and dentist appointments. Do you have records of doctors and dentist appointments where this boy went regularly as every boy should?
There is evidence that he went to the pediatrician through the age of at least 12. Those we have. Those are contained in the
12?
DCF records. They're referenced in the DCF records, okay?
What about after 12?
It's not her responsibility. She was not the parent. There was a father that was involved. The father called the shots.
Okay.
The father called the shots.
Records.
We want to shift,
the
burden
out?
Onto her. She doesn't need to provide the records.
Did she throw the records out?
What records? She doesn't need to provide records. What I'm telling you is We have records that reflect this child was going to a doctor, and these records reflect issues with his weight as early as 4 years old, and he was cleared by doctors. We want to put everything on Kim Sullivan. The father raised
this kid. Do you have the names of let's say the records, I'll give you that. Let's say the records were thrown out and it's not Kimberly Sullivan's responsibility to keep the records.
Correct.
Do you have the names of the doctors and dentists that this boy saw? And I'm going to put
Dr.
it to you
Falk.
To say age 12 is not good enough after fourth grade.
What duty does, what legal obligation does she have? She's not the custodial parent. She did not prevent him ever from going to a doctor. His father called the shots. And mind you, he's been an adult for 14 years now. So he's not a child. He's not her responsibility. Nonetheless,
but he weighs the same as a 10-year-old boy. How can you explain anything about a 68-pound man who was behind a locked door?
Here's the problem with the weight. The weight itself doesn't prove anything. The state still has to connect the dots. What they're claiming is his weight was this because she starved him. He's going to have to get on that stand and convince a jury that that is the cause and effect, that that's the relation. Because just saying, hey, he's 68 pounds, that doesn't mean anything. Has anyone ever considered other reasons for his weight? He was underweight at 4 years old. He was underweight at 8 years old. He was underweight at 12 years old. And at each point, DCF was involved, the doctors were involved, and they were cleared. And my client and her husband were cleared of any neglect. We've gone over this, and they've been cleared.
Well,
these
again,
are not new.
These are the things that a jury is going to have to decide, as you and I both know. That's the way it's done. A prosecutor will lay out a very profound case, and you will have to, like I said, you don't have to mount a defense, but in this circumstance, I certainly would.
No, there will be a defense, but my point is, we can't just accept that this is a done deal. This is far from a done deal. And they can prepare any statement they want, and the people around him can make everyone feel good and sound good about reclaiming stuff. At the end of the day, he needs to get on that stand and convince a jury. And we're confident that if we have a fair and impartial jury, and if we have people that look at this objectively and don't just accept everything that's been fed to them by the police and by this accuser. We are confident that my client will be vindicated. She is adamant she has done nothing wrong.
Everyone deserves a fair defense, and I think you're doing a great job of it, and I really appreciate you coming on the show, because not a lot of attorneys do, especially early in the case. So thank you for this. I hope we can continue our conversations.
Absolutely, anytime.
Ioannis Kaloidis joining us, hopefully not for the last time. I do appreciate that, sir. Coming up in just a moment, online shopping is perfectly innocent, unless it proves you're guilty of murder. And Brian Koberger may just regret all the things he typed into his browser. We just got new documents from his quadruple murder case, and what the cops say he tried to hide may be just as bad as what they say he tried to buy. I'm going to show it all to you next. I poke around on Amazon. I put stuff in the cart. Sometimes I buy it. Sometimes I just forget about it. Sometimes I change my mind. Amazon's always good at reminding me, though, if I forget. One thing I do not do, however, I do not look for ways to erase the fact that I was ever at those sites in the first place. And if I am ever charged with four murders, that's probably going to help my defense. Not so much for Brian Koberger. New documents that just dropped tonight show Idaho prosecutors have some more heavy ammo against him in his quadruple murder case. We have been kept from these details for 2.5 years. That pesky gag order has seen to it. But little by little, morsels of information are dropping in the way of pretrial court documents, and tonight, a bombshell. We already knew that Koberger's Amazon history showed that he bought a K-bar knife, according to the prosecutors, and a K-bar sheath and a sharpener months before the murders. And we also learned that he searched for what the prosecutors call a replacement knife and sheath after the murders. Convenient. But today we learned that whoever's fingers were doing the walking on that Amazon account looked for ways to delete that shopping history right after the murders. Bad fact. Prosecution documents also show that the K-bar knife and sheath were, quote, shipped to Brian Koberger at his family address in Pennsylvania, end quote. The documents continue with, quote, after the homicides, activity from the same account show the user navigated pages related to the deletion of account activity, and a week later viewed pages associated with K-bar knife and sheath. This evidence establishes significant connection between defendant and K-bar knife and sheath. It's hard enough to hide something like that in real life, but whoever killed those poor kids was able to hide that, because no one's ever found the actual K-bar knife. But he screwed up with that, or she. This was found under the body of Maddie Mogan. And on that little snap, DNA. Prosecutors say that DNA led them right to Koberger. I believe the legal term for the stuff we learned in the document tonight is called mic drop. But Lisa Bonner knows a lot more about that technical stuff than I do. She's a managing partner of Bonner Law, and she's here with me live. Lisa, evidence found is one thing, but evidence that a defendant tries to hide is sometimes even more powerful.
Yes, it is. In this instance, it led them to connect significantly the search history and the connection between the knife sheath and the DNA. The search history clearly shows that the same account that was used to search for the knife, to ship to the knife, and to delete the history was the same name and email and the purchase history of the defendant. And that is
Ashley. that's a mic drop. So here's another mic-ish. Here's a little lavalier drop. And that is that they also said it's a family account, right? That's what the defense said. It's a family account. You don't know who in this family was buying the knife. We live in the Poconos and there's hunting and camping and all the rest. But the address is Brian Koberger. It's shipped to Brian Koberger. It's not shipped to mom and it's not shipped to dad. And by the way, if it is mom and dad doing the purchasing, was it also mom and dad trying to scrub that account after the murders?
Well, that's interesting because this is going to turn on the if the defendant is trying to establish that, that can be established during cross-examination. They were trying to get that evidence removed. And they were trying to say that is not going to happen. It's highly prejudicial. And in this instance, the judge said, that's not the case. If you want to say it's a parent's account, if you want to say it's a family's account, then you can challenge that in court. But this is relevant. This establishes a significant connection. And therefore, it is probative evidence that we are going to allow to be admitted. And you may challenge that on your cross-examination. It's as simple as that.
I always love the fight in court, the probative versus prejudicial. Everything, all evidence is prejudicial, right? It's like, what are you talking about? But I get it. Sometimes it's beyond the pale. However, the bushy eyebrows, it turns out the judge said, sorry, that's not something that's so prejudicial. That is an eyewitness account. The defense wanted to actually bury an eyewitness account. It did not happen. I suppose you're not surprised.
Oh, absolutely. I am not surprised because this is the only witness that they have in this instance. This is the only witness. Again, the judge said that the evidence was consistent and it was clear. The witness gave the same description of the eyebrows. The eyebrows was almost its own character, if you will, in this narrative. Mm-hmm. She was very clear about, I don't remember much about what the person looked like. I don't remember the nose. I don't remember the eyes. I do remember it was an eyebrow or an eyebrow, and it was bushy eyebrows. And that is the situation that we are looking at in this instance. Whether or not this was a consistent and clear connection. And it was not prejudicial. This was the only witness. And again, they can challenge this on cross-examination.
Yeah. Tough day for Brian Koberger and for his lawyer, Ann Taylor. Hey, Lisa Bonner, great to see you. Have a wonderful Easter weekend and look forward to having you on again. Well, thanks for doing it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, folks. Coming up next, is there a serial killer operating in New England? 7 bodies, 3 states, and 1 growing fear. Tonight, we talked to a woman who was stabbed 27 times by a serial killer, and yet she survived. Her warning? They're never considered serial killings until suddenly they are. What she sees in New England next. Coastal town in New England with seaside shops, ice cream stands, and sidewalks that were made for a weekend stroll. And now picture a serial killer prowling that town and picking out his next victim. This is not the newest Netflix series. It is the subject of police reports up and down the Eastern Seaboard. Only cops won't say if the latest 7 bodies are the work of a serial killer. But isn't that how every serial killer story begins? With a chain of mysteries, unconnected, until suddenly a pattern develops, a suspect emerges, and wham, a serial killer is born. Tonight, that very dark possibility is brewing along the East Coast. Between March and April of this year, 7 sets of human remains have been discovered across 3 New England states. The locations are tightly clustered in Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. Police won't reveal the key details like cause and manner of death, but we do know a couple of things. One body was stuffed in a suitcase. One was left near a cemetery. And one other case involved the skull found in the woods. At least 4 of the victims are women, but just 3 have been identified so far. 35-year-old Paige Fannin was found in the Norwalk River in Connecticut. 59-year-old Denise Leary was a mother of 2. She was discovered in New Haven, Connecticut. And 56-year-old Michelle Romano was found in the woods of Foster, Rhode Island. Here's what the Connecticut State Police said about these deaths. There is no information at this time suggesting any connection to similar remains discoveries, and there is also no known threat to the public at this time. But that doesn't mean that people aren't starting to worry. More than 61,000 people have joined a Facebook group on this topic, and the TikToks on this subject are racking up millions of views. Joining me now is a woman who knows a thing or two about serial killers. Jane Borowski was 7 months pregnant when she was attacked by the Connecticut River Valley serial killer. She was stabbed 27 times and miraculously lived to tell about it. It happened in Swansea, New Hampshire in 1988. And it happened after seven women were found stabbed to death in the same area. All were victims of the same man, and Jane is believed to be his only survivor. She now hosts the podcast Invisible Tears, and she is here with me now live. First of all, my goodness, Jane, I'm so glad that you're here with me, and I cannot believe that you survived 27 stab wounds. I want to ask you about that in a moment, but first, what are your thoughts about the story I presented with seven sets of remains and officials saying nothing to see here?
I find it suspicious. For first, I came across it online about a month ago, and then I started doing some research, and I'm like, this is awful suspicious. It just didn't sound right that they weren't connected, and the law enforcement was just so adamant about, you know, all these cases not being suspicious. It just didn't sound right to me.
You have such a stake in a story like this, and I want to ask you, what is the responsibility here between law enforcement not creating panic and yet law enforcement making sure that people like you and I are safe when we're out and about?
I think if they come forward and are honest that there may be some suspicious activity going on, I don't think that's going to spread panic. But what I think it will do is make people more vigilant. Like, you know, make sure they do the buddy system when they're going jogging or going for walks or letting somebody know where they are at all times. I think it's about keeping yourself safe. And so as far as them saying, well, you know, they're afraid to, you know, spread fear, I think the opposite. I think they should be letting people know that, you know, you need to be, you know, more aware of your surroundings and you know, be safe.
Yeah. And they should talk to you because, my God, your attack, 27 stab wounds at the hand of the Connecticut River Valley serial killer. And it is still unsolved, Jane. I didn't realize that. That person is still out there. Actually, let me ask you, do you think that person is still out there or do you think that person may be dead by now?
You know, I don't know. Supposedly, I'm the last one that he attacked. I'm the only survivor. And I don't know if he's still around, if maybe he's incarcerated or maybe he's dead or I don't know. I don't know if he's still around or not. I really have no idea.
We've been putting up two of these images. To me, they look very different. Is there one of these two images that looks more like the man that you remember, or how is your memory after such a horrifying attack?
The one on the left is the actual composite that I did. The one on the right is something totally different, but the one on the left is definitely the composite that I did.
Yeah, because the one on the right looks completely different. The hairline looks different. Everything looks different. Maybe it was the police trying to suggest maybe this is what he looks like if he's got a wig or glasses on. But can I ask you, how on earth did you survive 27 stab wounds?
I was pregnant. I was 7 months pregnant. And I truly believe I survived because of my daughter. My daughter wanted to live. So it gave me the strength to live and to survive. You know, she ended up surviving also, which she blessed me with a granddaughter. So yeah, I feel blessed and I'm thankful that I did survive.
I'm going to call you again because we're going to continue to watch this story as the details come out. Jane Borowski, thank you so much for being alive and for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Still to come, tomorrow is the most violent day of the year. 250 years of history says so. So is there something you should be doing to circle the wagons? What is up with this week and tomorrow in particular, April 19th? I'll tell you next. You You may be gearing up for a nice Easter weekend, and today is Good Friday, but tomorrow is Bad Saturday. I'm not kidding. April 19th is one of the most deadly days in true crime history, and it's a culmination of a very deadly week, right smack dab in the middle of April, the season of crime. The Oklahoma City bombing happened on April 19th. The siege at Waco happened on April 19th. Unless you think that's a coincidence, it's not. Waco was the end of a 51-day standoff between a heavily armed Branch Davidian cult and federal agents, and nearly 80 people died. The Oklahoma City bombing was planned to mark that anniversary. Mike Boettcher covered it all in 40 years as an award-winning reporter for NBC, CNN, and ABC. And I talked to him about the deadly ripple effect of the Waco siege. Do you think that Timothy McVeigh chose the date April 19th specifically because of Waco, or was it a coincidence that was a happy one for him?
No, I think he specifically chose it because of that. It's also what's known as Patriots Day, the beginning of the American Revolution. And also, some historians say the beginning of the American Civil War occurred when Massachusetts troops on their way to Washington were attacked in Maryland. That happened on April 19th, 1861. It is one of those days on the white supremacist calendar, and I don't think it was an accident at all.
You know, I look back on my almost four decades in this business, and I am trying to take a 30,000-foot view of the anti-government movement in America. I feel like that might have been a real beginning for the movement we see very vocal today. And I want to get your perspective on that. Do you think that that was the genesis of what we hear from those who are so anti-government today?
It was part of the beginning. You know, there was a lot of buildup to this going back to the late 1970s and 1980s. You had the Ruby Ridge incident in Idaho that had occurred. You had groups like the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord that was an Arkansas-based group. That was militant. You had Aryan Nation. You had the Order. You know, bank robbers who were going around using that those robberies to fund what they said would be attacks like Timothy McVeigh's in 1995. There was a building movement, then a crescendo on April 19th, 1995. What happened with this? Was, and I know because that was my job for a year, was to track and talk to the people who are in the middle of these anti-government movements, these extremist white supremacist movements around the country, and figure out what was going on out there in our country. And, you know, the movement had gone underground at that point. Now, a lot of people thought, oh, they've gone away. The country has learned its lesson. But no, they went underground and they were biding their time. And a lot of these groups are back again.
Mike Boettcher, what a great conversation. Coming up next, it was a blockbuster hit because Ocean's 11 could never really happen in real life, could it?
You're going to need a crew as nuts as you are.
Who do you got in mind?
Smash and grab job, huh? Slightly more complicated than that.
When we come back, an LA story worthy of an Ocean's sequel. With a jewelry store, a vacant theater, and 20 million reasons, you'll be on the edge of your seat. Back with the goods right after this. Characters, and not just because he's George Clooney. I've seen every movie in the franchise, and I'm still hoping for Ocean's 14. But until then, I'm getting my fill with the evening news in Los Angeles. Because a crew, just like Ocean's, has pulled off the jewel heist of the century. Their epic caper began in a vacant movie theater right next to, you guessed it, a jewelry store. The crew drilled right through the wall and right into the safe, and then made off with about $20 million in cash and jewels. This was how the store owners found their place the next morning. So was this an inside job? Well, you be the judge. The crew knocked out the surveillance cameras and shut off the alarms. But one thing is pretty clear. This is no insurance scheme, because the owners of Love Jewels didn't have any. They said that theft insurance was too expensive. Tonight, the jewel thieves are still out there somewhere, just like Danny Ocean and his crew. But the owners are hoping for a different Hollywood ending, where the crew goes down the drain. All right, make sure you check out my podcast, Drop Dead Serious, because tonight I'm dropping a really good one. It's the Brian Koberger extra bonus episode, where Jennifer Koffendoffer, former FBI, joins me to tear apart all of this new information, the bombshell information in the latest filing, that he was looking to wipe his search history, according to prosecutors. It's going to be a good one. Also have a great Karen Reed recap that sets the stage for Tuesday. So if you're feeling a little, I can't remember where that case is, check it out, Drop Dead Serious, YouTube or the podcast. That's it for us. Cuomo is next. I'll see you on Monday.